everyone, welcome to Energy in Transition, a weekly series of virtual fireside chats that we're speaking with the key movers and shakers in the energy sector to get their views on the future of the industry, how we get to net zero, and how things are being affected by COVID-19. My name is Jim Jordan. I'm a partner, an energy partner at the leading national law firm, Waitmans, and I specialise in construction and commercial aspects of projects. Each week, we're going to be tackling a different topic, and today we're looking at the transport sector. I'm delighted to be joined by Steve Hobson, who is the editor of Motor Transport Magazine. Motor Transport Magazine looks at news and analysis on UK haulage, distribution and logistics. Steve, thanks very much for joining me today. Before we kick off with the questions, it would be really useful if you could introduce yourself in a bit more detail about what you do and what your magazine covers.
Yes, Motor Transport, it's been around since 1905, so it's been around for a while. It's been covering the transport industry, the road freight transport industry, since the dawn of the industry when diesel was first coming in to replace steam, and ironically electric. I started doing 100 years ago, coal and motor transport, and there was a huge debate 100 years ago about whether electric or diesel was the right way ahead, and here we are 100 years later and we're about to have that debate again. So it just goes to show that nothing much changes. I've been editor for 10 years. I spent my whole working life really in business-to-business journalism. My previous job, actually increasingly relevant, was editor of a magazine called Utility Week, which, as it says, covers utilities, which includes the power sector. And as we get further into this, we'll see that the energy sector and the transport sector are going to become increasingly inextricably linked. So the two are going to get more and more relevant to each other, and it's something we're going to be looking at more and more in motor transport, is where the energy comes from. The magazine, as I say, it's a business paper. And we do cover vehicles to a certain extent, but we are very much focused on the business aspects of road transport, whether that's the own account operators, the likes of Tesco and Sainsbury's, who do run very big fleets, or the third-party logistics operators, the XPOs, the DHLs, the AD Stobarts of this world. We cover them all. We're a business paper about the business of road freight transport, so that's motor transport.
Thanks, Steve. Parking COVID-19 for now, what are the main changes you've seen in the transport sector over the last 12 to 18 months, the main talking points? Has it been heavily focused on this net zero move, or have there been other issues that people are dealing with?
Well, I think most business journalists will tell you that the industry only really cares about an issue, 2 days after it's been introduced in law, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, crikey, we haven't done much about that. So you can write about things in the future till you're blue in the face. You've got to bear in mind most of our readers are very hands-on, getting the stuff delivered today. You know, the trucks are out on the road today. That's their main issue. So motor transport, 95% of motor transport is about current day-to-day issues which face road transport operators. And yeah, we do try and lead them down the path of, you know, looking ahead to the future, because, you know, net zero is 2050, 30 years is a long time away, you know, for most people working in industries outside their working lifetimes. But it's quite hard to get them enthused about it when, as I say, they're mainly concerned about getting that load into a Tesco RDC right now. So we are a very practical, hands-on magazine, giving people day-to-day guidance. And I guess really in the last 10 years, things haven't changed a huge amount. The big changes in the last few years have been the arrival of what we call Euro 6 trucks. Now, the EU, for the past 20 odd years, has been introducing ever stricter legislation around the emissions from diesel and now natural gas methane trucks. And so Euro 6 arrived in 2014. It was the last big change that we all expected from the EU in terms of cleaning up emissions from diesel trucks. So that was a big issue. And obviously most of our readers, who are the big fleets, they are now all running Euro 6 trucks and they are very, very clean. The other big issue, which is like poverty, is always with the industry. The big issue is, for especially the 3PL operators, is getting a decent return on their investment. It's a very, very, very competitive industry. There is no regulation in terms of the amount of operators that can run. There are about 80 or 90,000 what we call operator licenses in issue, and the barrier, if I wanted to go out and start a haulage company, the barriers are incredibly low. There are certain criteria which the traffic commissioners who regulate the industry set, but you have to have £7,500 in the bank for every truck you want to buy and operate. Now that's not a huge amount of money. So even if a third-party logistics operator goes out of business, those 50 trucks you might have been running don't disappear. Someone else will buy them from the administrator at a very low price, and before you know it, they're up and running. So margins are very, very low. Now, the reason I mention that is because it's very difficult for the industry to invest in the future, this new technology we're going to be talking about, when they are making so little money. There are clean air zones appearing all around the UK in various cities. There are about 30 cities which don't currently meet the EU air quality standards, and so the government's tasked them with introducing clean air zones. And I've been to quite a few of the meetings, you know, local area meetings in Birmingham, Manchester, Sheffield, where the cities are talking about introducing a clean air zone, where you have to have one of these new Euro 6 trucks to go into this inner city area, or pay £100 a day fine, typically. Well, we call it a fine. It's not technically a fine. It's a charge for non-compliant vehicles. It's not a fine. You're not doing anything illegal by taking a Euro 5 truck into one of these clean air zones. But to encourage people to run the latest, cleanest vehicles, they are going to be charging people £100 a day. London's already had that sort of thing for a long time. If you live in London, we're well used to congestion charge, toxic charge, a T charge, and things like that. But they're going to be spreading out. And the reason I'm talking about profitability is a constant theme when you go to these meetings with operators is we just don't have the money. You know, I've got a fleet of Euro 4, Euro 5 trucks. It's going to cost me £200,000 to upgrade to Euro 6. I'm only making 2% margin because my client's screwing to the ground on the rate. Where am I going to get the money from? And so there's a lot of issues about, you know, where the money is going to come from, because this industry, logistics industry, feels terribly undervalued. We're going to talk about COVID a bit later on. I think one of the benefits, and I personally think it's going to be quite a short-term benefit, is that the general public has actually appreciated how important the logistics industry is in terms of getting their toilet roll and their milk and their bread on the shelves. Fortunately, that sort of thing doesn't last very long. It's a very brief halo effect, and then the industry retreats back into its, you know, its RDCs behind the high wire fences, and you'll see the trucks on the road. And, you know, most people don't really understand what the industry does and how efficient it is and how well it does things until there's a problem. And as I say, unfortunately, I don't think this halo effect is going to last very, very long. So this profitability is a major problem, where the money's going to come from to invest in these new low carbon vehicles. And the other issue is, it's not directly related, but it's partly related, is the industry does suffer from skill shortages because it's not a very sexy industry. It employs 2 million people, and there are fantastic careers available for young people, not just drivers and warehouse staff, but, you know, in the management layers as well. It's a great place to work. You know, I talk to people who spent all their lives in logistics. Most of them fell into it by accident. Perhaps they had a family member who worked in the industry, or, you know, father, uncle, brother, occasionally a sister or mum. But very few school leavers, if you go to a class of 15, 16-year-olds and say, where do you see yourself working in 5 years' time? You can bet your bottom dollar, none of them will say, oh yeah, I see myself running a logistics company. It just isn't on the radar. So the lack of profitability means that the wages are not perhaps as good as they were 10, 20 years ago. So a lot of the issues come back to the fact that rates are very, very low, and everyone talks about how to get them up. But, you know, if you're a Tesco, you've got a lot of buying power, you spend a lot of money in logistics, you can negotiate a very good near to zero profit rate to get the work done because they're putting out a lot of volume. So that's going to be a challenge. That's always been a case, as I say, I'm doing my 100 years ago column, and we were talking about the rate for the job 100 years ago. So nothing's going to change. It's a competitive industry. It's been deregulated since the Second World War. You know, anyone can enter the industry. There's no limit on the number of licenses available. You just have to prove to the traffic commissioners that you're a fit and able person to run the industry. So that is a fundamental issue which isn't going to change. The COVID thing, it's, as I say, it has put a bit of a halo effect around the industry, but I don't think that'll last very long, I'm afraid.
Steve, that's a really, you've set the scene in a really clear way there. And it's really interesting, you know, it's quite easy to see the headlines and the move towards a green economy and net zero. But actually, when you see it in the context that you've explained with the, you know, the sort of potentially skill shortage and the tight margins and lack of profitability, it's really interesting to, you know, we have to question the feasibility of this move to net zero in the transport sector. But so in terms of the context that, you know, the scene that you've set, it would be quite useful if you could just touch upon what the, you know, the different technologies that are potentially available to the sector, and I guess also in that context, because again it goes back to costs, one way or another. is the cost of the infrastructure required to implement those technologies as well.
One distinction very clear before we start talking about low emissions and net zero is that people often confuse local pollutants, which cause very poor air quality in urban areas. They're mainly oxides of nitrogen, we call them NOx as a sort of generic term, and particulates, which are very, very small subparticles which come out of diesel engines. There's no doubt about it, the estimates vary, but perhaps 20,000 people in this country die every year, or they have their lives shortened as a result of poor air quality. It's mainly because that is why we're introducing clean air zones. They're not low emission zones, they are clean air. They are designed to clean up the air in certain local areas, mainly in town centres. It's a real problem, don't get me wrong, you know, rush hour in particular, because you know, when a truck or a car or a van is stuck in traffic idling outside a school, it is causing local pollution. Now, the solution to that, as I say, the industry's come up with, the truck manufacturers, is Euro 6. Now, people think about talk about dirty diesel all the time, and it's a real bad misnomer, because a Euro 6 diesel is incredibly clean. You can virtually breathe the exhaust coming out of it, because the technology that goes into that vehicle, there's virtually no NOx, and the particulates are captured by a filter. They are very, very clean vehicles, which is why the 30 cities who are looking at clean air zones have accepted that a Euro 6 truck can go into those zones any time of the day or night and do their deliveries and not cause that local pollution. When we talk about net zero, we're talking about carbon. Now, we've known about carbon emissions and climate change since 1990. It's been a long time. It's not new. And yet we just seem to have got a big panic about it all of a sudden. We've known about the effects of carbon emissions and global warming for many, many years. I mean, I did a little pub quiz the other day, and one of the questions was, who's the first world leader and when to warn about the impact of climate change? And it was Maggie Thatcher back in 1990. You know, she made a speech in one of the Geneva climate conferences warning about this. And why is it all of a sudden, oh my God, you know, climate change is really serious? We've known about it for a long, long time. But unfortunately, the technological investment has gone into the clean Euro 6 trucks. Still burn diesel, still burn methane, fossil-derived fuels. They are very clean in terms of NOx and particulates. They haven't really addressed the carbon issue. Yes, engines have got more fuel efficient, so you might get 10 miles to the gallon instead of 9 miles to the gallon from, you know, a diesel truck. They have got better, and that's a big step forward. It might not sound a lot, but when you're hauling 44 tons, to get an extra MPG requires a lot of effort. So the vehicle manufacturers have made the engines more efficient. That's mainly because a more fuel-efficient engine sells better than a less fuel-efficient one. You know, the operators are all, as I said, working on very tight margins. They're not going to buy a truck which is burning more diesel or now increasingly more gas. So there is a commercial imperative for the truck manufacturers to make the engines more fuel-efficient. But what I'm saying is it's been tiny increments. You know, they're emitting 10% less carbon for every ton kilometre now, not 100% or 50% less, which is where we've got to get to in the next 30 years. So you could argue we're starting this race relatively late compared about how long we've known about it. We've known about it for 30 years, and now we're going to give ourselves 30 years to get to net zero. And it is going to be a massive challenge. It's a lot harder to decarbonize heavy trucks than it is to reduce the NOx and particulates. Now, don't get me wrong, the truck manufacturers would probably gasp when they hear you say that. So they spent billions and billions of pounds developing these Euro 6 trucks. And if you talk to them in private, they'll say, yeah, we've known about carbon for a long time, but the legislation has driven us down this NOx and particulate route. Now, crikey, you know, we've done that. Now they want us to cut the carbon emissions by 15% by 2020 and by 30% by 2025. And that's going to be a massive challenge. But don't get me wrong, the truck manufacturers, they're like farmers. You know, it's a bad year or it's a worse year. You know, we spent all this money doing Euro 6 and now they want us to do this and this. You know, the likes of Daimler, they're a big company with deep pockets. You know, they will meet their targets. They will do their bit. They will get to these 15% and 20% reductions by the dates because they have to. You know, it's a no-brainer. The other 80% reduction is going to have to come from the operators and choosing different technologies. And there are several options on the table. And further on down this list, you asked me to come up with three words which might be a blockage to achieving net zero. And the biggest word, the one which everyone hates this industry, is uncertainty. If we knew where we were going, if we had a clearly defined roadmap from where we are now to 2050, everyone would be very happy. It's this uncertainty. And I don't necessarily blame the UK government. I think it's true of all governments. It's very difficult for a government to pick a technological winner and say, right, 30 years' time, we are going to get rid of diesel trucks, we're all going to be running on hydrogen. If they could say that when we had a clear roadmap and everyone could get on board, no government in the world is ever going to say that, because, you know, what if hydrogen, what if it goes wrong? What if hydrogen turns out to be, you know, something that we're not quite sure it is? So at the moment, they have set this net zero target and they're leaving the industry, the energy industry and the transport industry to try and work together to work out a way how we're going to wean ourselves off diesel for heavy trucks. Now, it's already started because I mentioned before, gas, natural gas. It's much bigger on the continent than it is in this country. There's an awful lot of natural gas trucks, and they do give you roughly a 15 to 20% reduction in CO2 emissions compared with fossil diesel, which is worth having. And a lot of people see methane as an intermediate step on the road to net zero because it does reduce the carbon emissions. It is a cleaner fuel than diesel. There's no two ways about that. And it does give you a slight reduction. The next step that we can take without huge technological change, without ripping out all the diesel engines from the 400,000 trucks out there, is biofuel. That can be biodiesel or biogas. It's a renewably sourced diesel alternative or gas alternative. You don't need to change the engine a huge amount to run on biofuel. Now, there's a lot of talk about biofuel. The low carbon vehicle partnership is very keen on biofuel. The problem is, where's it come from? Well, it's had a few false starts with sugar cane and things like that in Brazil. And the big problem is, if you have to rip out a food crop to plant a fuel crop, that isn't regarded as very sustainable these days. So we're looking for alternatives. Companies like McDonald's, if you see a McDonald's truck going down, it will say this truck runs on 100% cooking oil. And, you know, McDonald's have a lot of used cooking oil when they're open, obviously not now. When they're making all the burgers, they generate a lot of used vegetable oil, which can be taken away on the truck in a big tank underneath the trailer, goes to a recycling plant, and it's made into biodiesel. Now, there aren't many companies that have that ready source of used cooking oil to convert into biodiesel. So biomethane and biodiesel, it's in short supply at the moment. And this leads me on to the next issue, is going to become increasingly important as we move forward. At the moment, you're buying diesel put into your truck. You're buying it from a petrol forecourt, it's delivered in a tanker, it's completely separate from the home heating and the home lighting, the electricity network and the gas network. Now, increasingly, if you're producing biomethane, let's say you're a sewage works and you're producing biomethane, you sort of got a choice really what you do with it. You can put it into the grid to heat homes, or you can, you know, make it, sell it as a transport fuel. Now, we've got the renewable transport fuels obligation and the renewable heating initiative, I think it's called the RHI. And at the moment, those two are competing against each other and they're not working together. So you've got a choice of what you do with your biofuel. And if you can make more money by putting it into the grid to heat homes, then you will. And it fascinates me when I go to a lot of these conferences about renewable fuels and they go, the big problem is going to be what we're going to do with our 20 or 30 million homes. You're probably too young, Jim, to remember the changeover from town gas to North Sea gas 40 years ago. But the gas board had to go around and change the burners on every single gas cooker and every single gas boiler. We moved from what we call town gas, which is ironically high methane, to natural gas, which came from our North Sea gas fields. And we had to do that for every single home. Now, if you want to move heating, home heating, away from natural gas, fossil gas, to a hydrogen-based economy or even electric heating, that's going to be a massive job. As I say, when I go to a lot of these conferences, they go, transport, that's the easy bit. You can do hydrogen, you can do electric. What are you worrying about with transport? It's the easy part. What are we going to do with all these homes? Now, what we're going to do with all these homes, how we're going to decarbonize home heating, is going to have a massive impact on the transport sector. Right now, the impact is this competition for biofuel. That's going to have an impact. But far more, at the moment, the government is debating about whether we're going to decarbonize our electricity supply with renewable electricity, and then we're going to rip out all the gas boilers which currently heat our homes, put in electric heating, or we're going to replace all the methane in the national gas grid and the local gas networks with hydrogen. Where that comes from, we'll move on to in a minute. And we're going to carry on using some sort of gas type fuel to heat our homes. Whether we go down the electricity route to heat our homes or the hydrogen route to heat our homes will have a big impact on transport. So uncertainty, there it is again. There's a lot of debates going on at the moment about whether the electricity networks are going to become, you know, our source, our route towards decarbonising, or whether we're going to replace methane with hydrogen. Hydrogen, it depends how you make hydrogen. There's different types of hydrogen. There's a lot of industrial hydrogen out there right now, but it's made by what they call steam methane reforming, which is a very dirty way. You use gas and fossil gas to make hydrogen. It's a very inefficient way of converting one form of energy into another form of energy. If we're going to go down hydrogen as a clean source of energy, it has to be made using renewable electricity through electrolysis. So you could argue, in a way, it doesn't really matter whether we go down a hydrogen route or an electrical route, we're going to need huge amounts of renewable electricity to power our future economy. And thank goodness we're doing all right. I mean, I read the other day, we went the first, partly due to the COVID lockdown and the reduced demand, but we went our first month, I think it was, without putting any coal-fired generation onto the grid, which is fantastic. We still burn a lot of gas in our power stations, and the difficulty with renewables is, if it's a windy day, there's plenty of electricity around, but people probably aren't using much energy because, you know, they're not doing the right lot. If it's a very sunny day, then people need air conditioning. If you've got wind, that's no good. You need solar as well. Intermittency is a huge problem for the renewable energy industry. What do you do? How do you store the energy? Now, this is another example of how transport and the energy sector could perhaps work together, because if you've got a lot of wind farms out in the North Sea thrashing away in a windy day, but there's no demand for the energy, they're actually giving it away. Electricity prices can go negative. I never heard that before, but yes, if there's too much energy on the grid, they will pay you to take it away. So what you could do then is either make hydrogen from this surplus electricity, which is being generated from wind or solar, and you could store that energy then as hydrogen to use in people's homes or to put into trucks later on. Or if we do move very quickly to a very large park of electric vehicles, when those vehicles are plugged into the grid, yes, they need charging at some point. But let's imagine everyone goes home in their electric cars, electric vans at 5:30, plugs them into the grid to charge. They don't need charging at 5:30, 6:00. That battery could actually be used to give energy back to the grid, help balance the grid. And then it'll be recharged when you have surplus cheap electricity, which, to say, it could be actually, you know, negative priced, charges at midnight when there's very little demand. So there are ways around this, but the devil is always in the detail. It all sounds very good and very, you know, interesting, but actually achieving all this in practice is going to be a massively complicated issue. And the uncertainty surrounding it is holding back investment in a lot of these areas. Just one other slight complication is all the energy networks, the national grid, the gas networks, they're all regulated monopolies. They're monopolies regulated by Ofgem. Now, Ofgem, their job is to make sure they just don't go out and add to their asset base at the expense of consumers by building lots of stuff which they think, yeah, we're going to need this, we're going to need that, on the what they call the contingent basis. Ofgem is very, very wary of that, and they will not allow too much money to be spent without absolute evidence that there's going to be a demand for this and there's going to be a return on this investment. So Ofgem could be seen as a blocker on the way towards this new renewable future, because National Grid in particular wants to spend a lot of money reinforcing some of their nodes around the country to either make hydrogen or to charge electric vehicles. They want to do it on the contingent basis. They want to be ready, so the National Grid is not a blocker to all this. But Ofgem naturally is saying, just hold your horses. You know, this might not be the way we go. So uncertainty could be the biggest enemy of progress, because a lot of people are waiting for the perfect solution. And sometimes the uncertainty and the desire to make things perfect can get in the way of things which actually do a little bit of good. So we have to make sure that we're not all sitting on our hands waiting for this clear roadmap to the future. We've got to start acting now, basically, because 30 years is not very far away. We've got to start making some decisions. And we are seeing it. I mean, certain fleets, the DPD, UPS, parcel companies, they are already making investments in electric vehicles to go in, mainly into London, because London is going to become one of the leaders in terms of very low, ultra low emissions, as they call it, and that will include carbon. Now, to my mind, putting battery vehicles into towns is brilliant, and we call them zero emissions. There is no such thing as zero emissions. There's so much embedded carbon in the vehicle itself that you can never call it zero emissions. And even if, you know, every kilowatt of energy generated on the network was coming from wind power, you're still going to be using carbon. You can't transmit it through thin air by magic. You've got to build things. You've got to put carbon. You've got to put concrete in the ground. you've got to put, you know, just towers up. They all use carbon. And again, I'll mention this now, you know, imported carbon emissions is a big issue, which we haven't really focused on in this country yet. We slap ourselves on the back and say we've met all our Paris Accord targets. That's because we've exported most of our manufacturing. We don't make the right lot in this country anymore. So it's very easy to say we're a low emissions economy when all our stuff is made in China and India and Bangladesh. If we start counting those emissions, then, you know, we're not so green, actually. And so this talk about zero emissions is a complete misnomer. There's never going to be any vehicle on the road, whether it's powered by battery or hydrogen or biomethane, is totally zero emissions. I think we've got to acknowledge that. We can get things lower. And I think it's the important word with what we're talking about is net zero. So that means we're going to plant a lot of trees in India to allow for the fact that we buy a lot of stuff from India, which is made using carbon there. So, sorry, that's a bit of a confusing sort of thing. I don't know quite where I was meant to end that.
No, Steve, it's not. It's a really interesting insight you've given, because there are lots of issues there that people just won't have considered or thought about in terms of the challenges that the industry faces. I suppose before we sort of head on to the three key words, which you've alluded to already, what's your gut feel in terms of where we are now? That you've talked about the halo effect, or the temporary halo effect. Do you think what's happened in the last 3 or 4 months will be something that facilitates a move to net zero, or do you think that in 6 months' time we'll be back to where we were and just having the same discussions? Or I guess, given what you said earlier, the answer might depend on having a clear roadmap as to what is actually required and by when, possibly. I mean,
yes,
it's a difficult one.
It is a difficult one. COVID is a very difficult one. I mean, I've got a gut feeling in the back of my mind that in 2 years' time, it'd be like, well, you'd be a pub quiz question. What was that virus began in C back in the early 2000s? And I personally don't think it is going to have a fundamental shift in our economy or the way we socialise. We've been through things like this before, and yeah, you know, it has a huge impact in the short term, but in the long term, people are people and they will just go back to doing what they wanted to do. It's interesting that the impact of the lockdown has obviously meant there's a lot less traffic on the roads. So the freight vehicles, which are still running about delivering all the stuff that we still use every day, their productivity has actually shot up. Now, it'd be interesting to see if we could perhaps keep some of those gains, because a trip running along the road with no traffic is a lot more efficient in terms of carbon emissions than one which is battling against traffic. So there are a couple of ways in which you might be able to hang on to those gains. If we could convince a lot more town centres in particular and a lot of retailers to accept out-of-hours deliveries, so the trucks could run before the rush hour rather than get stuck in traffic at 7 o'clock, if they could make their deliveries earlier, they could hang on to some of those productivity gains that we've seen. Now, whether that will happen or not, we've tried this before. I think during the Olympics in 2012, there's a huge increase in out-of-hours deliveries because of the Olympic lockdown. And everyone said, oh, the Olympics will change the game, because once people understand that we can do these deliveries without having the trucks get stuck in traffic, trucks don't cause congestion, they suffer from it. You know, they might take up a bit more road space than a car, but in terms of the numbers, you know, as I say, there are 400,000 trucks on the road. I have no idea how many million cars are on the roads, but it's orders of factors, you know, of 100. More than trucks. So trucks don't cause it, they suffer from it. So if there was lessons to be learned, I would like to think that you could say, yeah, now that the trucks are running much more efficiently and much burning a lot less fuel, how could we hang on to that in the future? And I think avoiding rush hour deliveries would improve air quality, because the trucks are not getting stuck in traffic and sitting idling outside schools, which is, you know, what we don't want. They'll be in and out before the cars start to use the roads. If more people start working from home, then again, that might lead to a permanent reduction in traffic congestion, which would be fantastic for the freight industry, because it really would increase their efficiency and their productivity and use a lot less fuel. So that may be one change from COVID. There have been winners and losers in the logistics sector from the lockdown. Obviously, the events and hospitality industry is on its knees, and you know, that has had a knock-on effect on logistics there. Those guys are really, really suffering. The food sector have been working overtime. They've actually been allowed to relax the very tight regulations on the limits on driver's hours, so they can actually do more deliveries with the existing workforce. That's not something I would favour maintaining. I mean, depending on who you talk to, we are short of 50 or 60,000 HGV drivers in this country. You could say, well, how does that work? You know, the food's still getting delivered, the petrol's still in the forecourts. You know, what does that mean? It just means everyone's working a lot harder than they should be. I personally wouldn't favour a permanent relaxation in driver's hours to solve the skill shortage. Those guys are driving, you know, 9 hours a day, 6 days a week as it is. I think that's enough. I don't think we should expect them to do any more. So I hope that is a temporary thing from the COVID. Whether people work from home more permanently, my first few weeks, speaking personally, my first few weeks of lockdown were a nightmare. I really missed the office. I missed the banter. I missed going to the pub, you know, after on a Friday night after work. But I've sort of adapted. I'm sort of quite home now. I'm, you know, working from my front room. So, I think that's one thing which might come out of this. I think people will say, I don't need to go to the office every day. You know, sit in my car 2 hours, I'll work from home. So that might be one permanent gain from the lockdown is if people don't use their cars as much, it leaves the roads free for essential freight traffic. I'd like to think that was one spin-off benefit.
Good. Okay, so we're moving on to sort of the final couple of questions, which we're asking all of our interviewees. You partly answered one of them with your reference to uncertainty. But in the first instance, if you could provide three words that represent getting us to net zero.
Yes. Well, they're all three very, very cheesy words. I was trying to think of really down-to-earth concepts, which the freight industry, it's a very down-to-earth industry. They don't really like bullshit. But unfortunately, all three words are slightly, what's the word? I don't know. Anyway, I mean, the first one, and it's one of my least favorite words, but I have to use it, is sustainability. Sustainability is an overused word. You know, technically there are three pillars of sustainability: environmental, social, and economic. But all those three do affect the industry, and the net zero will involve challenges for sustainability on all three of those levels. Because reducing carbon emissions from heavy trucks, which have been dependent on diesel for 100 years, while still turning a profit, to use those two pillars of sustainability, is going to be tough. There's no two ways about it. But the other word I came up with, again, I tried to think of a better word, but it's adaptability. This is an incredibly adaptable industry. I've got every faith they will find a way. There's no two ways in my mind that this industry is incredibly efficient and adaptable, and they will do whatever they're asked to do, you know, by government or by the regulators or by their clients, their customers. They are very customer-driven, and certain very large customers are already pushing their contractors, their 3PLs, down a green route because they're just saying, if we're Marks and Spencers or Honda or Waitrose, you know, we have to be seen to be leading this societal change. So even ahead of legislation or what the government says, certain big customers are already encouraging, let's say, their contractors. And what's been nice to see is some of these very big, very environmentally aware customers are actually sharing some of the financial pain with their 3PLs. They're saying, yeah, if you do go out and buy a fleet of gas trucks, we'll help. We'll help with the cost of that, and we'll help with the infrastructure, because it's very difficult at the moment to run a gas truck, even a natural gas truck, all around the UK. I think there are, 12 filling stations to fill. And if you're tramping all around the country, that's no good. So a lot of people running gas trucks, for example, are putting in their own refueling stations on their sites. That only works if your trucks come back to base every day, but the people can do it are doing it. And the last word, again, it's a bit of one of those words which I sort of hate, but responsibility. This industry it does feel the weight of its responsibilities very, very heavily. You know, they do care. It does annoy me when people talk about juggernauts and, you know, trucks, heavy trucks tearing at the road and all that. This is an incredibly responsible industry. They do take their responsibilities to safety, to the environment, to society very, very seriously. And they will do everything in their power to do the right thing. There's no two ways about that. Just turn to the negative side of things, possible holdups. I mean, costs. We talked about costs before, and that cost and uncertainty, they sort of go together. The more uncertain things are, the more expensive it will be, because you're going to make mistakes. You're going to go down a road which turns out to be a blind alley, and then you've got to come back. So uncertainty and cost are two linked barriers. And the third word I came up with as a potential block is technology. There's been loads and loads and loads of trials of battery electric vehicles and fuel cells, and getting things from proving the technology to work to actually getting it on the road is a huge hurdle. It's massive. You can run trials and the vehicles work very well, and then it just disappears, and you sort of go back a couple of years later and say, well, what happened to that trial of those fantastic, lovely battery electric hydrogen fuel cell vehicles? They go, yeah, well, they worked okay. It just wasn't quite the right time. So the technology is there already. This is the frustrating thing. There is technology available to do all this. It's just finding a way to overcome the cost and overcome the uncertainty to get the technology off the drawing board, off the test bed, out of the pilot schemes, into large scale use. That is, we don't seem very good at doing that. I don't know why that is. As I say, you can go and test a fuel cell truck tomorrow. You say, when can you buy one? I don't know, maybe never. Yeah, that is quite annoying.
Steve, unfortunately, that is all we've got time for on today's session, but you provided some really, really interesting insights, and also you've put the sector into context as well, in terms of the issues that it has that, you know, I certainly wasn't aware of. So it's interesting to see, to listen to you talking about the issues around getting to net zero, the reality or otherwise of that, and obviously the costs and the margins involved in doing that. So thank you for your time. This interview will be available to view on our website, waitmans.com, as well as on other social media channels, including LinkedIn and Twitter. So I hope you enjoyed the interview today. There will be others, so keep an eye out for those. Until then, it's goodbye from me. Thank you.
Goodbye. Thank you, Jim.